This series of six lectures, titled Introduction to Pro-Capitalist Macroeconomics, was delivered in August of 1985 at the Second Jefferson School Summer Conference, The Intellectual Foundations of a Free Society II, which was held on the campus of the University of California in San Diego. In following these lectures, it will be helpful to have available the corresponding lecture supplement, which is referred to from time to time in the lectures. If you are listening to this series as part of my full program, the supplement can be found on the CD labeled Lecture Supplements. If you did not purchase the full program, the supplement should have been sent to you either on a disc or as an attachment file to an email. Please print out the supplement. The material in this lecture series corresponds to chapters 13 and 14 of my book Capitalism, and was the first draft of those chapters.
Well, as you know, the subject of the six lectures that I'll be giving is called Introduction to Pro-Capitalist Macroeconomics. I put the word macroeconomics in quotation marks because it's not a word that would normally be part of my vocabulary. Macroeconomics is usually defined as the study of the economic system as a whole, in contrast to another branch known as microeconomics, which is held to be the study of the economic activities of individuals, individual companies, and individual industries. In my judgment, this is a totally arbitrary split. I share the view of Henry Hazlitt in Economics in One Lesson that the essence of economics consists in looking at the effects of things on all groups in the economic system, those directly affected and those indirectly affected, long run and short run. So from that perspective, all of economics is simultaneously the study of the actions of individuals and individual companies and industries, but always in relation to the rest of the economic system. And what happens in practice as a result of this division is one half of economics studies the actions of individuals while attempting to deliberately avoid, or at least claim that there is something wrong anytime the actions of individuals impact the rest of the economic system. The ideal concept in microeconomics is to treat the individual as though he had no effect on the rest of the economic system. If he does, he's called an oligopolist or monopolist. And macroeconomics proceeds with very minimal ability to tie the actions in the economics, to tie economic aggregates back to the actions of individuals. The only reason I use the term macroeconomics is because I will cover a very major issue which is dealt with in macroeconomics courses, namely, why is there unemployment? I will also be covering what determines wages, and if by some miracle there is time after that, what determines the general rate of profit. Had I gone totally crazy, I'd have included a section on savings in the supplement I distributed, but I'm afraid there won't be much time to get into that. And normally, if I teach a full course, after dealing with profits and savings, I would then have a critique of Keynes and then go into inflation, but we won't get into any of that material. Now, the typical macroeconomics course as taught consists essentially of trying to instill one central proposition, in my judgment, which is the proposition that a free economy, left to its own devices, cannot escape from a problem of permanent mass unemployment. The typical macroeconomics course teaches that a free economy cannot avoid permanent mass unemployment. The only solution is major government intervention, principally in the form of fiscal policy, F-I-S-C-A-L, and that really means the government should run at chronic budget deficits. Now, That's the basic positive teaching, that you need government deficits and a larger government rather than a smaller government. The more government spending financed by government deficits, the better. That is supposed to be the indispensable condition of preventing or combating mass unemployment, which would otherwise exist. For the rest, these courses make absolutely no effort to combat the fallacies that the average student walks in with about major areas of economics. They couldn't combat fallacies because they're instilling fallacies. As we'll see, if any of you take macroeconomics, especially an intermediate level course, if you look in the index of the book and you look under the heading Keynes Effect, you will see exactly what I have described as the consumptionist Keynesian view of the economic world in Figure 1 in the supplement. After chapters and chapters of very abstruse, befuddled reasoning, Keynes ends up with the notion that demand is exactly the way I've said the consumptionists describe it. There's no serious discussion of profit or saving or the foundation of economic progress in any of these courses. And this is after considerable improvement in the last few years. At least now, in the textbooks published in the last 2 or 3 years, you'll generally find 1 or 2 chapters giving some kind of serious exposition of the quantity theory of money, which shows the role of the quantity of money in determining many important things in the economic system. But that's about the best that you'll find in those courses after they're improved. All right, well, the place I want to begin with is a discussion of unemployment, and I want to review what I have referred to as the consumptionist view of the economic world. Consumptionism is the name I give to the idea that people by nature desire a strictly fixed, limited amount of goods. Consumptionism proceeds on the assumption that people need and desire just so much wealth, and that's it. And I illustrate this idea on page 2 of the lecture supplement. I label it fixed aggregate demand. And that vertical demand curve is expressing the idea that there is just so much output that people are prepared to buy. Unless something extraordinary is done, people are prepared to purchase, let us say, just so many automobiles, just so many homes, just so many shirts, etc., etc. Now, suppose we begin, and the volume of production in the economic system happens to be equal to the limited amount of goods and services that people wish to buy. Well, that idea is expressed in Figure 1. Initially, I show on the lower diagram, on the vertical axis, we're measuring labor employed, the number of workers working. Now, some point represents full employment. I've labeled that point F on the vertical axis. That's where full employment exists. Given the quantity and quality of machinery, the state of technology, the volume of what is produced varies with the amount of labor employed. The more people who are employed, the more will be produced. Well, if you look at the horizontal axis, we're measuring output. And I'm assuming that initially, when there is full employment, when employment is at F, output will be at A. So we have output of A corresponding to full employment. And if you look up at the upper portion of Figure 1, you'll see that that output happens to be what is demanded. But now what happens if we have, let us say, improvements in machinery? Improvements in machinery mean that any given amount of labor will be able to produce more. Well, if you look at the lower portion of figure 1, and you trace across the output that will be produced at full employment, we have now a larger output, which I label B, output with improved machinery. Well, this is supposed to create a problem, because this output with improved machinery, if we draw it on the upper portion of the diagram, we now have a supply of goods which exceeds this allegedly fixed, limited demand for goods. It's claimed people are only prepared to purchase this fixed, limited quantity, DD, and now production at full employment exceeds that quantity. Supply is greater than demand. Well, this notion, I think, is extremely widespread. Consider all of the times that you've heard the claim, machinery causes unemployment. Now, what is the underlying reasoning which leads people to conclude that the adoption of better machinery causes unemployment? Well, it's exactly what I've presented here. It's the notion people are prepared to purchase just so much, DD. Now, with improved machinery, the number of workers who used to produce DD can now produce more than that. They produce a larger supply, SS. And here's the problem, will people be able to go on producing SS if the market will only buy DD? Well, the answer is no, so what's supposed to happen? The volume of production which can be maintained is no greater than the limited demand. So production will be pushed back. Production will end up limited to DD. Only what happens to employment at that point? To produce DD used to require F of workers. Now how much does it require when labor is more efficient? It's less. It's the point directly below A. If you were to extend this line DD down into the lower diagram where it intersects the curve labeled output with improved machinery, well, it appears from this that the adoption of machinery is actually destroying work. The implication of this is there's a fixed stock of work to be done. There's some precious commodity called the work to be done. And picture it in a warehouse. And now scientists, inventors, and businessmen are improving the methods of production and making labor more efficient. And what is the effect of their activity? Well, they are looting the community's precious stock of work to be done. They're destroying the work to be done by people. And now that requires a remedy, if that's true. And who comes around and offers to help us protect ourselves from this problem? While the scientists, inventors, and businessmen are busy destroying work, who are the great heroes making work? And they actually say they're making work. The labor union leaders. So on this view of things, on the one side, there are the scientists, inventors, and businessmen, and they're destroying the community stock of work. On the other side, we have our defenders, union goons, who will be helping us to make work. And they can be joined by some other equally desirable types, as we'll see. Well, now you see, the problem as perceived by consumptionism is there's just so much need and desire for goods, and therefore, by implication, just so much need for work. That limited amount of work which is required to produce the limited amount of goods that people will buy. And that's it. And then from their perspective, the fundamental economic problem becomes not how do we produce goods, but how do we step up the need or the desire for goods. That's what they consider to be in short supply. They take production for granted. They think we have the ability to produce already or is soon about to exceed the need and desire to consume. And so the problem from the point of view of the consumptionists is, how do you make needs and desires for wealth, and how do you make work? The two go together. Making more needs and desires is indirectly a way of making more work. They think we need to get people to need and desire more, or the equivalent result would be achieved if we could make people work less efficiently. That would make work directly. Now, this idea is amazingly widespread. I have no doubt that many of you have picked up history books, which you might take as authoritative, and you may casually read somewhere, oh, in 1819, a major depression broke out in Great Britain because of overproduction. And this is just thrown off as though it were a serious statement. And the author of this is absolutely ignorant. He is saying, he's taking this theory and attempting to explain depressions by it. And you've all heard the doctrine, I'm sure, depressions are caused by overproduction. Well, that's equivalent to the notion machinery causes unemployment. It's claiming at full employment, we're producing more than the market will absorb. Therefore, we end up producing the lesser amount that the market will absorb. Those who could have produced the extra, they are locked into unemployment. Well, I'll take questions at the end. Now the question arises, well, what are the remedies suggested for this? Or let me point out a further implication, which I named in the article, Production versus Consumption. Not only machinery is considered an evil or anything that increases efficiency, but suppose, for example, married women want to go to work in greater numbers. We start out at full employment is point F. Now a large number of married women decide they want to go to work. And what happens to the full employment point? Well, now full employment will require the employment of more people. That's up at point G. But if we have G workers working, even without any improvements in machinery, G workers will produce more than F of workers. And so once again, production will exceed demand. Now, I'm sure everyone here has read letters to the editor. Why don't these married women stay home and stop taking jobs away from a breadwinner? Well, it's exactly the same notion. There's just so much work to be done by all groups combined, and any new entrant into the labor market will take a job from some present job holder, and now there'll be no job left. And the same doctrine is at the base of attempts to limit or stop immigration. It underlies prejudice against minority groups. And the unions, who love to talk of their humanitarianism, that's the reason they're opposed to child labor. They're not really interested so much in the ill effects of people under 18 working. Their view is they want to limit the number of people in the labor market because they think if someone 17 or 16 worked, he'd be taking a job away from an adult. All right, well, the problem is supposed to be that we have a deficiency of the need and desire for goods and indirectly a deficiency of the work to be done in the world. And how are we supposed to correct that? Well, there's nothing better to correct it than a good war. You've all heard the notion that war is a period of prosperity. Well, war is perceived as the means of shifting this fixed aggregate demand curve up on the top of figure one as far over to the right as you like. With war, the government has a huge need for tanks and planes and munitions and so forth, and the demand curve will now be moved as far over to the right as necessary and would require even more than we're able to produce. If we're not lucky enough to have a good war, well, then the government could increase its peacetime expenditures. The notion that government public works projects running at deficits in peacetime promotes full employment. That's the same idea. There are other methods that I've referred to. The consumptionists don't believe that this aggregate demand curve is absolutely unmovable. It can be moved not only by war and more government spending, but also by fraud. And that is their inherent view of the nature of advertising. The consumptionists hold that by man's basic nature, all he really needs is maybe 1,500 calories a day and a little stool and a cot. He needs the low budget accommodations of a monk. That's the way we would live if we followed our true nature. But we can be corrupted by advertising and this demonic Jones family that we are trying to keep up with. So at any given time, we may in fact want more, and if we've already been deceived into thinking we need these extra things, well, the fixed demand curve that we start with will already incorporate a lot of these unnatural artificial elements. And if the advertisers could go at it still more strongly, perhaps they might induce us to keep pace with the growth in the ability to produce. But observe, by the very nature of the case, the consumptionists have to regard advertising as fraudulent, even if it succeeds in moving the demand curve to the point of absorbing all of the output, because their view of human nature is that by nature, properly, we desire just so much. And whatever we desire over and above that is unnatural and artificial. And we're only misled into it by deceptive advertising and the desire to keep up with others, not because there's any actual foundation in our nature for wanting more. Well, a further major point that I've referred to, the consumptionists believe that population growth might help to solve the problem, short of a war. They think if there's a larger number of people, they're valuable qua consumers. If we have more people, each new person has his own stomach and a need for food, he has a need for clothing, etc. And you'll find after World War II, there were many alleged marketing experts who were talking about the great effect the baby boom would have. And their method is they count up the number of people and they say, well, they'll all have to get married and they'll all need a house and a car and furniture. And this is tremendous. This will be a huge outlet for goods. Observe, they're looking at people in their capacity as consumers. They think the value of additional people will be they will be there willing to take the goods off the market. Their contribution is they're bringing needs to the market. Now, if you ask, well, what if some of these people, when they reach the age of 20 or 25, go out and work? Well, that is actually supposed to be an evil, because that will mean there are now more people in the labor market. The problem is that we are able to produce more than we are willing to consume. The contribution of the new people is to act as consumers. To the extent that they also act as producers, they're not helping to solve the problem. So observe, the ideal of consumptionists, of the consumptionist view, is that the larger population should live as parasites. Their contribution is precisely their parasitism, their willingness to consume without producing. If they produced the equivalent of what they consumed, we would still have a deficiency of consumption versus production. It's only if they will consume more than they produce that they're held to make a contribution. Now, this leads to a further point, which I omitted to go into production versus consumption, the consumptionist doctrine on imperialism. The exact same thought that we need more people who will bring with them their quota of needs and desires to help solve the problem of overproduction. Well, the consumptionists take that idea and they apply it on a global basis. They look at countries with enormous populations of impoverished people. China and India are the best examples. And they say, well, here in China, there are perhaps 1 billion people, in India, 600 million, and look at all of the things they don't have. Each family there doesn't have an automobile, a television set, a telephone, whatever. And they regard all of these things that they don't have there, which they have confidence that our advertisers would be able to get them to want. This is an immense storehouse of demand. So the overpopulated, impoverished countries are regarded as potentially having an enormously valuable contribution to make. They will do us the favor of taking our goods. And again, there are historians who routinely explain World War I on the basis of this theory. They say, well, prior to the outbreak of World War I, the advanced countries of Western Europe were all experiencing problems of domestic overproduction. So British industry didn't know what to do with its output. The British public didn't want it. The French public didn't want their output. And collectively, they didn't want their output. So now they needed to find, quote, markets, unquote, for their surplus production. And what better place than among the countries, the backward countries with enormous populations. And the acquisition of these impoverished countries as markets was held to be such a valuable matter that it was worth going to war for. All of the European countries, it was claimed, were so badly in need of the Indians and the Chinese and whomever to take their goods for free, mind you, that they had to go and fight for the privilege of seeing who could accomplish this, who could get this gold mine. And observe, again, just as in the case of population, the value of these alleged foreign markets is supposed to be in their capacity as consumers. They're held to be valuable as takers of our output. The moment they become suppliers of output, like Hong Kong or Japan, well then, they're supposed to be causing unemployment. It's exactly the same as if the larger population of children goes to work. The value is held to lie in their role as consumers, not producers. And the same notion surfaced again in the Vietnam War. The Marxist authors, and we'll find that there's a major overlap between the Marxists and the consumptionists. Marxist authors routinely claimed the United States was in Vietnam in order to be sure it would have a toehold in the vast markets of Southeast Asia. Observe, their notion is, we want Vietnam and ultimately China and whatever, in order to have them take our goods from us, but not to be producing goods for us. Our prosperity will come from sending goods to them. Only they're too smart to take our goods for free, so we have to send in the CIA and the artillery to force them to do it. Now observe, this same idea shows up in the whole terminology that you routinely hear about in the press and radio, the balance of payments and the balance of trade. What is called a favorable balance of trade or payments is an excess of exports over imports. The more exports, the better. Imports are supposed to be harmful. They cause unemployment. The ideal, what would be the most favorable balance of trade, would be if we only exported and didn't import. Well, the underlying idea is exactly the same as consumptionism. We need, in order to have full employment, we have to have foreign markets who will take our goods from us. Now, in truth, the real value of foreign markets is the goods we receive from them. We want foreign trade not to give our goods away, but to be able to receive more goods in exchange than we could produce with the same labor at home. All right, it should not be surprising, I think, that if you scratch a consumptionist, you will find a socialist. And this is why there is such an overlap between Marxism and consumptionism. Think of how a consumptionist views the capitalist system. By his terms, if we increase our ability to produce, we cause impoverishment. The notion that depressions are caused by overproduction comes down to the belief that people are out of work, and being out of work, are unable to afford to pay their rent. They can't afford housing. They can't buy the food they like. And why can't they? Well, at bottom, they can't buy food because they can produce too much of it. They can't afford housing because we have the ability to produce too much. I mean, this is an incredible contradiction. So a consumptionist says, under capitalism, improvements in production work utterly perversely. And the consumptionist believes that under capitalism, we prosper from war. Now, the great majority of consumptionists, as ordinary human beings, are not in favor of war, but their idea is that there is, under capitalism, an economically very good side to war. So capitalism prospers from evil. What should be good causes impoverishment. There's the same problem with advertising. Advertising is viewed as inherently fraudulent, yet necessary. And imperialism appears as something necessary. Well, anyone who holds these ideas and who stops to think about the significance of these ideas would have to conclude that capitalism is a totally perverse economic system. And these contradictions and paradoxes would be resolved under socialism. So this is why the two go together. Now, let us turn to what I consider the true state of affairs with regard to the need and desire for goods. I think all one need do is open one's eyes, and the situation that you will find is, if you look at someone who does not own an automobile, almost certainly he would be very happy to own one. If he has one, he would like a newer, better one. If he has several of the newest, finest automobiles, he would like a yacht or a plane. If he has a yacht and a plane, he'd like a yacht on which the plane can land. If you want to consider the extent of our need and desire for goods, ask yourself the question, how much are you currently earning, and what kind of income would you have no difficulty living up to if only you could earn it? Now, if we want, I advance this as a rough measure of the work that's out there to be done. Right now, the average income in the United States is something in the neighborhood of $20,000 a year. Well, I don't think anyone would have very great difficulty in living up to an income of $100,000 a year. It takes the average person roughly 40 hours a week to earn his $20,000 income. Well, consider how long it would take you to earn the $100,000 income you'd have no difficulty in spending at your present rate of pay. You'd have to work 200 hours a week. Well, to produce the physical volume of goods that we would like to buy with a $100,000 income, in the present state of technology, would take roughly 5 times the amount of labor that we now perform. If we wanted to produce 5 times the output, which we would have no difficulty whatever in consuming, we'd have to do, in the present state of technology, 5 times the work that we now do. Well, my point is, there is vastly more work out there to be done than we are remotely capable of doing. We would all of us end up in the hospital from exhaustion before we could earn a fraction of the income we would very much like to have and would have no difficulty in spending. Now, add to that a further point. When you wake up in the morning, how many of you take positive pleasure in making your bed? I don't think there are very many people who do. Well, consider How many of you would have difficulty in finding work, let us say, for 2 full-time servants, if you could afford them? Well, now, consider that there are only so many people. For each person, there are only 2 arms. As an absolute maximum, the total amount of labor that can be performed in behalf of any one person, on average, cannot be greater than the labor of 1 person. And there are many people who don't labor, small children, old people, etc. So the actual amount of labor available per person is less than the labor of 1 person. All of us would like, just as servants, to have the labor of several others. And our desire in terms of goods implies the employment of a very substantial number of people. Well, the point is that in reality, there is a scarcity of labor. Labor is scarce. Labor, in fact, is the fundamental scarce economic agent. You know, you can pick up any textbook of economics and there'll be some chapter, usually chapter 2 or 3, and it will talk about the problem of scarcity. Well, what is scarce, we shouldn't view goods as scarce. It's not that the goods are here or they're not here. What is fundamentally scarce is our ability to produce. And that, because labor is scarce, that is what we need to strive to improve in terms of its productivity. There is always a scarcity of labor, and I refer to the fundamental scarcity of labor and the virtually limitless amount of work to be done in the world, point 6. Well, point 7, I say, why the scarcity of labor is ineradicable. The scarcity of labor cannot be overcome by having more people work. No matter how many more people we would have work, labor remains just as scarce, because each additional person has needs and desires for an amount of wealth and an amount of labor far greater than he himself is capable of performing. So if we imported 10 million Mexicans or whatever, that would not reduce the scarcity of labor. Each of them would come with his own needs and desires. Each of them would like to have 2 servants and the output of 5 other people. So the scarcity of labor is not overcome by the employment of more people, nor is it ever overcome by improvement in the methods of production. For example, when the electric motor was invented and the internal combustion engine, these radical advances raised the productivity of labor enormously. But we didn't use them to sate ourselves with ox carts and candles. The same radical advances in means of production were accompanied by equivalently radical advances in the kinds of goods that could be produced. If the day ever came when technology was so advanced that we really could sate our desire for goods of the present type, if the day ever came when we had such immense productive power that you could afford as many automobiles as you now have suits or dresses and vary them with to match your outfit, if such a day ever came, that kind of radical improvement in technology would be accompanied by people wanting their own personal rocket ship or house on the moon or whatever. There would always be far more in the way of what we would want to have and would like to have as consumers than we would be producing. Now, I think as a universal proposition, you might find perhaps 1.5 monks somewhere who would be a possible objecting case. But apart from that, I think as a universal proposition, the willingness to consume always exceeds the willingness and ability to produce. And the reason for that is all that you require for the willingness to consume is an active imagination. And to have an active imagination costs you nothing, and it's boundless. The qualities of imagination are nothing is cheaper than to imagine yourself having a Rolls or whatever. And There's no limit to what you can desire on the basis of just imagining. But when you get down to production, it's a much different story. Production is always physical. Production ultimately comes down to people having to labor. No matter how advanced the methods of production, the machines never operate by themselves. It always takes people to produce. Production is always physical. It is always limited by the physical. It takes effort and is limited, while the desire to consume rests on the imagination and is boundless. So I think that is the underlying fact which creates the willingness to consume always being greater than the willingness and ability to produce. Now, I've had the experience in presenting these ideas to some people of being misunderstood, and I fear that might happen now. So I have put in point four. I don't want to suggest that the desire to consume is an innate burning passion, and that everyone, or even most people at all times, are powerfully motivated by this desire. I'm saying the willingness to consume is always greater than the willingness and ability to produce. That doesn't mean that the desire to consume is at all times or in all places so powerful that people will go out and take risks to launch new industries or to spend their nights learning new skills. We've had long stretches of history, and there are many societies today, where you could say legitimately, I think, the desire to consume is deficient relative to people's vital needs. They're not motivated sufficiently to go and work to produce even enough to live. But wherever that is the case, the real problem is that people are unwilling to produce. Their desire to consume, their lack of desire to consume, is only a problem insofar as it's insufficiently strong to lead them to produce. There could be no greater error, I think, than to view the Middle Ages as suffering in any primary sense from a lack of desire to consume. It wasn't the case in the Middle Ages. People said, well, look, I could have two crusts of bread, but I only want one. My desire to consume is deficient. The only sense in which the desire to consume could be held to be deficient in the Middle Ages would be that it wasn't strong enough to go and induce people to work and produce more in the face of adversity. But there was never a problem, and there is never a problem in any society or culture where the desire to consume does not measure up to the existing willingness and ability to produce. We never have to worry about making the desire to consume adequate to the existing willingness and ability to produce. The only value in stepping up the desire to consume further from an economic point of view is insofar as it leads people to produce more. All right, well, I would like now to, I think it's necessary to state what I think is the basis, not just of a desire to consume. I don't want to take the position simply that we happen to have a desire to consume. I'd like to give some indication, even if perhaps it may be inadequate, of an underlying philosophic basis for an objective need for consumption without limit. I don't want to leave you with the impression in any way that it just happens that in this culture, under the influence of the Jones family, we desire a lot, but there's no real need for it. I think that if we live up to our nature as rational beings, on the basis of our nature of as rational beings, which we do not automatically have to accept, as Ayn Rand says, we have to choose to be rational. But if we do choose to be rational, then there is no limit not only to our desire, but to our objective need for wealth on this basis. The fact that we possess reason gives us the basis for a limitless range of knowledge. There's no limit to what we can know by virtue of the fact that we possess reason. And our range of knowledge our limitless range of knowledge creates the potential for a limitless range of action and experience. We are capable of knowing from the existence of subatomic particles to galaxies. And we're capable of perceiving all kinds of similarities and differences and patterns and whatnot. This ability to know is the foundation for an ability to act and experience that is equivalently boundless for all practical purposes. But now we have to ask, what is the physical means of action and experience? If we want to physically act in the world, we need material means of action. That's wealth. And wealth is also means of experience. Wealth in the form of machinery of all kinds, including things like automobiles, phonograph records, airplanes, whatever. All of this is means of action. And wealth in the form of works of art, sculpture, landscaping, fine furniture, whatever, these are means of experience. Well, I think the abstract basis of a limitless desire for wealth is the fact that we have a limitless potential for action and experience, and the material means of action and experience is wealth. So, in my view, it's not an arbitrary matter that our desires keep growing as our ability to produce keeps growing. It derives from our nature as rational beings, if we choose to follow that nature. Now, I would like to go a step further and say, not only is the need and the desire for wealth limitless, so that there is absolutely no problem of a lack of demand on that score, but I want to go further and say that it is production, more production, which is the actual source of more demand. Not only is it the case that in the face of more production, there is in fact no problem of any kind of a lack of need or desire for it, but further, more production is the actual cause of more demand. And this proposition has a name. It's a very famous proposition in economics, and it is known as Say's Law, after an early 19th century popularizer of Adam Smith named Jean-Baptiste Say, S-A-Y. In my own view, the real credit for this law should go to James Mill, whose exposition I much more closely follow. Well, Say's Law is popularly stated as supply creates its own demand. In the typical macroeconomics textbook, Say's Law is ridiculed. It's interpreted as, well, the classical economists simply say people have money burns a hole in their pocket. I remember the first economics course I ever took in college as a sophomore. We had an instructor whose interpretation of Say's Law was, oh yeah, Say's Law, that means if you bring a truckload of refrigerators up to the Eskimos, they'll automatically want them because supply creates its own demand. That was his understanding of Say's Law. All right, to understand Say's Law, we have to begin by understanding what it actually refers to. And there are two critical ideas to keep in mind. It refers to real demand. I'll explain what real demand means in just a moment. And it refers to aggregate, that is, economy-wide demand. All right, let me try to explain what I mean by real demand. We have to contrast real demand with monetary demand. Monetary demand is merely the spending of money. The amount of money that is spent, that is monetary demand. For example, if last year $50 billion was spent to buy television sets, that is the monetary demand for television sets. The gross national product of $4 trillion, that represents the monetary demand for all consumer goods and a few other goods. Now, monetary demand, the mere spending of money, is determined basically by the quantity of money that exists in the economic system. Monetary demand is determined basically by the quantity of money. The more money, the more dollar bills that people have, the more spending of money. Nothing would be easier than to increase monetary demand. We could make it possible next year for everyone to spend twice as much money if we just created enough additional dollars. So monetary demand rests on the quantity of money, and I express the idea in equation 1 on page 1, the quantity theory of money equation. That simply says the volume of spending is equal to the quantity of money times the number of times in a year that the average dollar is spent. Well, everything that is denominated in money, any such figure that you may hear as gross national product, national income, any such figure depends basically on the quantity of money. If we wanted a larger gross national product, the only way that we get a larger monetary or nominal gross national product is with more money. Monetary demand, nominal demand, these are synonyms. The nominal and the monetary are synonymous expressions. Anything that is expressed in money depends basically on the quantity of money. For the average person in the economic system to earn more money, what brings that about is the existence of more money. Well, real demand refers to what the monetary demand can actually buy. It's the goods and services the monetary demand can actually buy. Monetary demand is just the money that is spent. The real demand is the goods and services the monetary demand can actually buy. Real demand depends not simply on the spending of money, but no less on the prices that have to be paid. Any given expenditure of money is capable of being any real demand. For example, suppose we consider the question, how many eggs can a dollar buy? Well, the spending of a dollar to buy eggs represents monetary demand. But how many eggs the dollar actually buys depends on the price of eggs. Well, $1 could be a real demand for one dozen eggs, if the price of a dozen eggs is a dollar, or it could be a real demand for 5 dozen eggs if the price of a dozen eggs is 20 cents. So the critical idea to keep in mind about real demand is that it depends on prices. The lower our prices, the greater is the real demand constituted by any given monetary demand. The lower our prices, the greater is the real demand constituted by any given monetary demand. Well, the way that production and supply create demand is they create real demand. Production and supply are the only things which can create real demand. Now consider, on page 1, I give a formula for the general consumer price level. And what I have in the numerator, I have demand for consumer goods, spending, divided by the supply of consumer goods produced and sold. Well, suppose spending is $1 billion. Or make it smaller. Suppose spending is 1,000. Spending is 1,000. Well, how will more supply make a given 1,000 of spending into a larger real demand? Suppose we started out, we have 1,000 of spending to buy 1,000 packs of cigarettes. The only commodity in this economy will be cigarettes. There's 1,000 of spending to buy 1,000 packs of cigarettes. Well, how can 2,000 packs of cigarettes make 1,000 of spending into a doubled real demand? Lower prices. If the price of a pack of cigarettes falls from $1 to 50 cents, the 1,000 of spending will buy the 2,000 packs of cigarettes. Well, an increase in production and supply operates to expand real demand basically by virtue of reducing prices. Now, we can see how, when this happens, real demand increases. Now, let's keep in mind that real demand is always the goods and services that you can obtain for the money you spend. Real demand is always the goods and services you can obtain for the money you spend. The classical economists often defined real demand as the will combined with the power of purchasing. We don't have any problem of the will. The will be there if the power is there. Well, now, suppose we have more money. Suppose we were able to spend twice the money, but there was no larger quantity of goods available for sale. Instead of spending 1,000, we'll spend 2,000, but there's still only 1,000 units of supply. Will the larger monetary demand represent any greater real demand? What will be the effect of the larger monetary demand? It'll just raise prices. More money demand by itself is not sufficient for more real demand. This is a vital point to keep in mind. More money demand by itself, in the absence of more production and supply, more money demand cannot create more real demand. It won't enable people to buy anymore. Well, what must be present, what is absolutely necessary if more money demand is to represent more real demand? More production. You see, if at the same time there is more money being spent, there are also more goods being produced, then the extra spending will not raise prices. If at the same time that spending goes from 1,000 to 2,000, production goes from 1,000 to 2,000, then the 2,000 of spending will buy twice as much. Prices won't rise. Well, observe, there are two points here. More monetary demand by itself does not represent more real demand. More monetary demand is insufficient for more real demand. More production and supply is absolutely necessary if more monetary demand is to represent more real demand. Now, the last point I'll leave you with before closing and taking questions. Suppose we have no more monetary demand. The monetary demand is constant. We just have more production and supply, which results in lower prices. Well, what happens to real demand? It's greater. Well, observe, more production and supply are not only necessary to more real demand, they are sufficient. More production and supply without more monetary demand are necessary and sufficient for more real demand. And I state all that for you in black and white on page 4. Tomorrow, what I want to do is elaborate the fact that Say's law refers to the economic system as a whole. We'll see that the major misunderstandings of Say's law arise when people forget this fact. Well, I think we have about 15 minutes for questions at this point, so let me get a crack at them. This gentleman right here.
Yes, you were originally talking about this notion that we have only a fixed demand, and how this argument is presented. I'm curious to know whether or not this is the idea of a fixed demand is seen as an explicit premise in, say, economics textbooks, where they're discussing these consumptionist ideas. And if so, what sort of a defense do they offer for that notion?
All right. The question, as I understand it, is the notion of a fixed demand an explicit premise in economics textbooks? I would say yes and no. In one chapter, you will find an author denouncing it as a fallacy. You may find it referred to as the lump of labor fallacy. There's just so much work to be done. But if you look deeper, especially in an intermediate level textbook, under the heading Keynes effect, you will find that they come back to this vertical aggregate demand curve. Now, the basis of it is involved and complex. I can assert what the Keynesians say in support of arriving at this conclusion. They claim that if production were to be any greater than indicated by this fixed aggregate demand, the rate of profit on capital would either become negative or be unacceptably low. What the Keynesians are claiming, the Keynesians say, we are limited, we end up with a fixed aggregate demand because any greater level of employment and production would result in a volume of additional saving and need for investment, which would reduce the rate of profit to an unacceptably low level. Now, I regret very heavily that I don't have the time to really go into Keynes, but I'll give you a one-line answer. What the Keynesians are claiming is that we are in this position of a fixed vertical demand because here we are, we're in the depths of a depression with mass unemployment. The rate of profit, the rate of interest is already close to zero. Many firms are totally unprofitable. The rate of profit and interest is as low as it will, as people are willing to accept. If we got back to full employment and recovery, we couldn't maintain it because then the rate of profit and interest would have to go still lower. The Keynesians are saying, in essence, if you think the rate of profit and interest are low in the depths of a depression, wait till you see what they look like in a recovery. And therefore, that's why we can't have the recovery. Now, I think their arguments are total and absolute nonsense, but it would take quite a few hours to give a full exposition and then a really detailed critique. But that's the rationale they give for it. Yes?
Right. You were talking earlier about the fundamental scarcity of labor or the scarcity of our ability to produce, mm-hmm. which it seems that you're really implying that what was really scarce is creativity and inventiveness in society rather than just people themselves.
Right, that's absolutely true. What is really scarce, a better way to put it perhaps, would be human productive ability. Human productive ability is the fundamentally scarce thing, and everyone who has a consciousness and work has some productive ability. That is scarce. Dr. Binswanger?
I was impressed by the split in their view between the collective level, where they're saying there's nothing, there are no needs left to satisfy, and then the individual level where they say that unemployment is a problem. Because if there are no needs left to satisfy, then unemployment just means a free vacation. And I think you brought that out. Am I correct? That the idea that unemployment is a problem means that those people need money. Correct?
Yes, but you see, the way they...
If that's correct, maybe I have an error in it, but my question is, how do they reconcile that in their own minds? Do they ever integrate those two facts?
The question is, why is there a problem in their own terms of unemployment if people don't want the goods? Well, they're just not producing them. Well, I think the problem as they see it, or to try to give a quasi-rational explanation, in their view, we have two categories of people. There are the producers who arbitrarily insist on producing more than they desire. See, the way I express it in production versus consumption, they've divided mankind into two categories. On the one side, there are people who allegedly insist on working without reward. They just want to produce and work, but they don't want the product. And then these people who want to work without enjoying the benefit, well, they can't do it because there's no one to consume their product. So then, for their benefit, we need a class of parasites who will complement them by consuming without working. So I think that's what it actually comes down to. Gentleman back here.
Yes, sometimes you refer to demand as a total demand that people can imagine or think that they might want if they had the money. And other times it seems to be what people could buy with the money that they actually have. And one would be unlimited and the other one would be limited. Could you clarify that?
I don't think I use the term demand to refer to the needs or desires. What I say is the need or and desire for wealth has no limit. But need and desire for wealth is not demand. The mere need and desire is not demand. India has immense needs for wealth, but hardly any demand. Demand always rests on a combination of need and desire together with purchasing power. And the purchasing power, as we'll see, is created by production. Now, what I would say is, potentially, demand is unlimited. If people had the purchasing power, there's no limit to the demand. What in fact does limit demand at any given time is production. Mr. Crawford.
Do economists actually confuse the difference between real and monetary demand, or don't they understand the difference, or are they deliberately making a distinction?
Do economists actually confuse the difference between real and monetary demand? I would say that almost all of them are aware of the difference in principle, which doesn't stop them from often confusing them in practice. But practically any economist now would know the difference between nominal and real. Yeah.
I mean, they seem to, when they say that you should have inflation to increase demand, They seem to treat that as real demand that they think they're increasing.
Those who believe that merely stepping up the creation of money steps up real demand, well, they do have this confusion. Yeah. Yes?
That question leads into mind. You said that more money demand cannot increase real demand. Does that apply to both short-term and long-term? Because I think that's what the inflation is trying to do in the short-term.
All right. More money demand can only represent more real demand if and to the extent that it is accompanied by more production and supply. Now, if it is possible for more money demand to result in that, then to that extent, there would be more real demand. But only if there is more production and supply. If there is no more production and supply, more money demand does not result in any more real demand. More production and supply is always absolutely necessary to more real demand. Now, it may be possible temporarily for more money to result in some additional output, but I would say that where conditions exist so that we cannot achieve full employment and full production by way of a fall in prices, it is extremely unlikely that we would achieve it by way of an increase in the quantity of money and in spending, because the same factors which operate to prevent a fall in prices will then operate to cause a rise in prices. But I'll have more to say about that when we come to the discussion of unemployment. Dr. Buechner.
I'm confused on the meaning of real demand and real supply. You're saying that real demand is the real goods and services that we buy with the money, and then you're also talking about increasing the real demand by increasing the real supply. So I mean, isn't the real supply the real goods and services? Why?
I don't think I use the expression real supply. Real demand is determined by supply.
Are they necessarily equal, or is there some distinction?
They are necessarily equal. The only way, you see, real demand is the goods and services the money demand actually buys. The real demand is equal to the supply of goods and services sold. The only way that any expenditure of money can buy more is if more is sold. Mr. Valiant?
In the short term, when in the throes of inflation, when there's more money chasing fewer goods, mm-hmm. and inflation begins to happen, don't people tend to step up their purchases of goods for fear of future higher prices? And in that sense, mightn't it increase the short-term production?
All right, the question is, if you have inflation, isn't it possible that additional spending might be accompanied by, give rise to, some additional production and supply? That is conceivable, but even under that condition, the proposition still holds, because the only way that the additional spending can represent any greater real demand is if and to the extent that there is more production and supply, even if it happens that the extra production and supply might be caused by the extra real demand. But at best, that's a very short-term phenomenon, because as inflation proceeds, sellers begin to raise their prices even faster than the spending of money increases, and you start to have less supply as the... You see, in the longer run, the effect of inflation on production and supply is to reduce it. Inflation, considered over any significant period of time, operates to reduce real demand. Inflation in a wide variety of ways undermines the productivity of labor, it undermines saving and capital accumulation, it leads to distortions in production. So it results in less production and supply than otherwise would have existed, and to that extent reduces real demand. And I think we have some visible evidence of that in the last years here in the United States. Because inflation has been curtailed, not eliminated, but at least curtailed, this has actually been accompanied by the first time in many years of some rise in the productivity of labor. There is more production and supply by virtue of our having less inflation. And certainly Argentina would have vastly more production and supply if they did not have inflation. A last question. Yes.
I had an economic professor who claimed that Say's law was invalid because if the producers are in tune with the consumer's wants, then it's a chicken and egg argument. You don't know which came first, and therefore it's invalid.
I can't quite understand the meaning of that point. You see, what we'll see is, what I'll try to show tomorrow is that the only sense in which an overproduction exists is in a case in which the producers are not in tune with the demand of the consumers. If we have an increase in production which takes place in a particular industry where it is not in tune with the demand of the consumers, then we'll see that industry overproduces, but to precisely the same extent in the rest of the economic system, there is underproduction. Say's law never held that no individual industry could be out of adjustment or could not overproduce. What it held is that there can be no general, economy-wide overproduction. It's perfectly possible for many different industries to be out of balance, and that's the problem, and that's what will be corrected. But there is no general or absolute overproduction. I think we've got to take a break now. Am I correct or not? We have, oh no, excuse me. I go till 10 o'clock, so you can get confused here. Yes, sir.
Would goods and services in existence be the sum of real demand plus unsold inventory?
Say that again.
Goods and services in existence in a given year be the sum of real demand, which is the goods sold that year, plus unsold inventory?
No, by real demand, I mean the goods and services that the monetary demand buys. If we look at Formula 1, the way I am using the word supply, I am taking supply as the supply of goods sold. So I would not say that real demand is equal to all of the goods in existence plus the supply sold. I'm saying that real demand is the goods that the money demand actually buys. It is what the expenditure in the numerator buys, which is expressed in the denominator.
If I have 1,000 bricks and sell 600 of them, the 600 would be real demand.
The 600 would be what the buyer buys, and that would be part of the total real demand. If there are 600 bricks sold, 50 refrigerators, on, and the total spending that year is $1 billion, then the real demand that the $1 billion represents is your 600 bricks and the refrigerators, et cetera, et cetera.
Unsold is just simply sitting there and is not included.
We're not counting the what is unsold can have an influence, but we are taking prices as a ratio of spending to buy divided by quantity sold. And what the spending actually buys represents the real demand.
Unsold goods that were produced.
That can be inventory or plant and equipment, but it is not the supply of goods sold. Now, let me point out the terms supply and demand have had different usages. The sense in which I am using the terms demand and supply are those in which the classical economists use them. The classical economists spoke of prices as determined by a ratio of demand to supply, a ratio of spending to quantity sold. So much is put up for sale, so much is spent to buy it. The price is formed as the product of this ratio. Now, in contemporary economics, the terms supply and demand have taken on a different meaning. Demand is defined as the set of quantities of a good buyers will buy at varying prices. Supply is typically defined as the set of goods sellers are prepared to sell at varying prices. You will find, nevertheless, that the classical usage still crops up very frequently in discussions of macroeconomics, because the concept that you really need at the macro level is the expenditure of money. Nothing serious would be lost if we use the term total expenditure rather than demand, but generally demand is the expression more frequently used. And the price at which goods are actually sold, the actual prices at which goods are sold, is equal to the quantity of money spent to buy them divided by the quantity of goods sold. Not divided by the quantity of goods unsold or the factories that exist. The actual price at which goods are sold is equal to the spending to buy them divided by the quantity sold. And how much the spending represents, how much the spending can actually buy, is determined by the quantity of goods that are being sold. Question in the back here.
Is there any limit to how much we can import over what we export without endangering our economy?
Is there a limit to how much we can import over what we export without endangering our economy? Imports never endanger the economy. What endangers the economy is government restrictions and government-sanctioned restrictions on domestic companies producing. If we have labor unions, for example, which are able to make our steel producers and automobile producers pay unemployment benefits which are higher than the wages received by foreign producers when they're working, If they prevent the adoption of more efficient methods of production, if we have inflation and taxation which prevents the accumulation of capital, then we have domestic industries which can't compete. That's what's causing their problem, not importation. Now, the amount of imports, I think a good way to grasp the issue of imports, suppose, as might have happened historically, suppose New York City were not part of the United States. It were an independent, free city. What proportion of the goods purchased in New York City would be imports? Well, virtually everything. Now, there's no limit to the amount of imports which might be desirable. The only thing, as I say, that can create a problem is if there are restrictions on the ability of domestic producers to produce. And even on a relative basis, suppose we have a country that is primitive. Let's say there's a desert island, as was the case in the Persian Gulf not many years ago. There's nothing there. Then a few years later, you see enormous modern oil refineries. Well, what brought those oil refineries about? All of that was imported. Was there too much? You see, the imports can represent the formation of capital. The imports that we're having in the United States today have been preventing the enormous federal budget deficits from having a much greater disruptive effect on the economy than they otherwise would have. But let me make one further point. If we have economic freedom, and this will tie into the discussion of production versus consumption, if it is true that there is no limit to the need and desire for wealth, if that is true, if it is further true that all that is required to create purchasing power is production, then the implication is that there is actually room for all the countries in the world to produce as much as they are capable of. And the principle is there is room in the world market for everybody. We don't really have to worry about the Japanese if we have economic freedom. Now, this is a very crucial if. Our industry can be competitive with the industry of any other country. Automatically, we will tend to export as much as we import in the long run if our level of costs of production is competitive with the costs of other countries. Now, I said the most fundamental element in production is labor. The fundamental cost of production is wages. But there are two elements to wages. There's the wages that you pay the workers, and there's the productivity of labor, the output per worker. If in one country the average wage is $1,000 a week, and the other country the average wage is $500 a week, well, they can both have equal costs if in the $1,000 a week country the average worker there produces twice as much. Two units at $1,000 a week is the same unit cost as one unit at $500 a week. So all different countries could be competitive if the wages in the different countries conform to the relative productivity of labor. If in the United States the productivity of labor is 25% greater than Japan, well, we can have wages 25% higher than Japan's, and there's no problem. But if we want wages 35% higher, then there's a problem. If in the different countries wage levels could correspond to the different productivity levels, all countries would be able to compete. It would just be a question of what particular commodities they specialized in. In order to have this happen, you'd need a free labor market domestically. If there's unemployment, the unemployed workers have to be free to bid down wages. That will make wages and costs competitive with those of foreign concerns. We can have full employment. Maybe it'll be in different industries, but there'll be full employment. Yes, Mr. Hurwitz.
Given the history of other economic schools and the results produced, why are these theories not more persuasive to otherwise intelligent people so they can call themselves economists?
Why are these theories not more persuasive to otherwise intelligent people? Well, I don't know that I can give you a satisfactory answer to that. You see, I consider my job to be to present to the best of my ability what I consider to be an intelligent, logically consistent theory. Now, by this time, the average professor, I don't think, has ever even been exposed to the kinds of ideas that I'm presenting. Very few people have read James Mill. And a major problem in the history of economic thought is that alongside of many very good ideas, the classical economists had very many bad ideas, which eventually led to their becoming ignored. Now, why, a better question perhaps, or an equally good question as to why people would reject a sound theory is why they would accept a self-consciously absurd theory. For example, Keynes openly says in The General Theory that wars and earthquakes could be a source of full employment and prosperity. He says that and people will accept it. Now, I think part of the explanation is philosophical corruption. For a long time, it has been fashionable in many fields for people to take satisfaction in raping common sense. I think that is a real factor underlying the support of absurd theories. The antidote in the way of sound theory, I think, has been badly undermined because, as I say, the classical economists were very badly mixed. Now, we have some excellent, more recent economists. The best, by far, in my judgment, is von Mises. He has not been well received, and there, I think, the basic reason is Mises is for laissez-faire capitalism. The overwhelming majority of intellectuals are in favor of socialism, or have been until very recently. And so they have just not been receptive to a body of thought whose conclusion is capitalism. And let me say even more. There are a variety of factors. First, there are the intrinsic difficulties of economics itself, which are enough but wouldn't be insuperable. Then there's the fact the implications of economic theory are pro-egoism. The teachings of economic theory reach the overall conclusion that the individual should be free to pursue his own self-interest, that self-interest is good and benevolent. Now, this contradicts the almost universally accepted moral doctrine of altruism. So I would say economics as a science is in a comparable state of difficulty as physics was at the time of Galileo. Galileo's theory of astronomy was difficult enough in its own right. It appeared to contradict daily observation. And it also appeared to contradict the teachings of the Bible and the whole foundation of Christianity. Well, economics, in many respects, appears to contradict the observation of businessmen. A businessman selling fans will think nothing will do better for his business than a heat wave, and what's needed is more need. Well, that's how it looks to him. He doesn't think and see that that will be bad for someone else's business. You can't increase total demand that way. Then on top of that, there's the fact that economics teaches or implies that self-interest is good, which represents a contradiction of the received moral doctrines. Then beyond that, economics implies an attack on special vested interests. A sound economic theory implies that no businessman should be having a tariff, that there should not be legislation supporting labor unions and so on. And those who are looking at their short-run interests don't want to hear such things. And then their action reinforces the altruistic view of morality. Because the attitude of many businessmen and the labor unions and so on is, well, we will get ours, even though it represents plundering the rest of the economic system. And then that feeds into a negative view of self-interest. And then as one last factor of a philosophical nature, economics is a highly deductive science. And it rests on a lot of confidence in the power of reason. And today's philosophers teach that you cannot trust reason. So the teachings of sound economics are not likely to be accepted for that reason, too. I don't have time for another question now. I really believe 10 o'clock is the limit, but perhaps the opportunity will arise tomorrow. Please save them. Thank you.
This